It is Saturday, July 13th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 889 and KUSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxel. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. I'm your host, Lyle Troxel. With me in the studio today is Bonnie Jean Primps, broadcaster, large, and mediator. Hi.
Howdy.
It's so nice to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you, too.
I'm a programmer and photographer and a radio host.
You look a little different these days.
Do I look different? I got the whole glass on my face.
You got that glass on your face.
I wear it all the time.
There's a little piece of glass right here.
Bonnie, of course, is talking about Google Glass. We chatted about it a bit last week. And this week, of course, it hits the news all the time. And here's a little story from NPR. Now, this is two things I want to mention, actually. One is that I listen to a lot of podcasts. Mm. And when I listen to podcasts, I don't like to spend a lot of time doing that. I like to get the data as quick as possible. So I listen to all my podcasts, my talk podcasts, on higher speed. And that kind of makes sense for people to listen to me because I talk way too fast.
You also talk at a higher speed.
That's right.
Is so interesting. I'm learning about your whole system, Lyle.
So here's a little story from, it's actually from the NPR Technology podcast.
Are we also going to hear this at a high speed?
We are. We're going to hear it at 2x speed, but I'm going to switch it to 3x speed in the middle of it if I get bored. So here you go.
I'm Bonnie Cornish, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. And we start at the Jersey Shore. Over the July 4th holiday, as throngs of people strolled the boardwalk of Wildwood, New Jersey, a fight broke out. It was caught on video by a passerby and posted to the web. We're hearing some of it now. But it wasn't a video camera or a smartphone that recorded the incident, but something new, Google Glass. The device has many features of a smartphone, but looks like a pair of eyeglasses. And joining us to talk about why this simple recording is raising some big questions is NPR's Elise Hugh. And Elise, first tell us, how did this come about? Where did this video come from?
Well, there was a documentary filmmaker named Chris Barrett who had just gotten some Google Glasses, and he took them out on a stroll to test them out. The glass covers a user's eye, and with a small screen that can display email, text messages, even show you the weather, it also shoots pictures and video. Barrett said he filmed some fireworks at first, and then on the boardwalk after, he came up on the scuffle. So from a first-person perspective, you can see the tense crowd, the shirtless men fighting, and a drunken throng. Eventually, police show up and arrest the scrappers, and you can see the whole scene as filmed by Mr. Barrett.
So what's the significance of this? I mean, there are tons and tons
of...
Just
to make mistakes, and
online.
We'll speed this
sure,
up again. This is three times.
Is available to a small batch of test users. We believe this
she
is the first arrest caught on the Google Glass camera. Glass can do many things, and video is one of them.
Like
and Google
Glass
is a lot like regular eyeglasses if you aren't really paying attention.
So how is this any different than what you could get by using a cell phone camera?
It isn't. The difference is that the folks in the scene were captured without the knowledge of that they were being filmed, essentially. Now, Barrett said that had he been using a smartphone to film, he would have gotten beaten up because somebody probably would have noticed he was shooting. So citizen journalism is certainly being made easier, which is exciting, but some fear citizen snooping is made easier, too. West Virginia lawmakers are already trying to ban Google Glass while driving, and Las Vegas casinos are banning glass as well.
So is this a sign of the future that we're all essentially, on undercover video?
Well, you could describe that as a sign of the present, even, with video cameras on our smartphones and the apps to share them.
All right, we'll fade that out. Now, that's, of course, from the NPR Technology Podcast, which I listen to very regularly.
You're a speed listener.
Yeah. So I actually do a speed listening like that, and I know that sounds kind of crazy, but that way I can get more data into my brain. One of the things that came up about it, of course, is that most people don't have glass, so most people haven't even tried glass. It was only like 8,000 units out, and therefore...
It's already being banned here and there.
It has been, and a bit of that, it's interesting, because as a person that explains it to people all the time, I get that people think about it as creepy, then they try it, and they go, oh, it's not... it's nothing special, really. And the other thing about it is that...
That's how they get you.
Yeah, maybe. The other thing about it is that the... unlike a smartphone, there's actually a lot of little micro cameras you can wear. I mean, if you're interested, for under $100, you can get a pendant camera that will record pictures all day long and no one can see it, really. It's really small. The glass that, by default, this thing that I wear on my face, actually lights up whenever I record. So it's easier to tell this recording.
Yeah.
So that's the thing I thought was a little strange, that they didn't mention that if this was in a dark street, you know, a boardwalk scene where it's kind of dark at night and there's a fight happening and someone's got Google Glass, the light, there's going to be a light on their face.
No one's going to be looking at the light on your face, Lyle. They're going to be looking at the fight.
Just as they wouldn't look at someone using a cell phone, I would assume.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's also, of course, novel at this point, and so maybe people did notice and didn't mind it because it was glass, and why not?
I can see that over the course of Glass's reign, you're going to be an enthusiast one could even say perhaps at some point an apologist for the glass, and I will continue to be a skeptic.
I look forward to you bringing up points in the future about my ridiculous early adoption. As we see security concerns that get way, things go really bad with glass, you can say, Lyle, you said it was a good idea. Now, the other thing is, I'm aware that, here's the thing about technology.
Anything can be used for evil.
That's right. It's actually easier to use technology for evil than for good, right? You take explosives, for example. They're useful. We can demolish old buildings. We can mine, maybe. That's not necessarily that great. But there's a lot of use for explosives. They're fun for the 4th of July, right?
Yeah,
but, of course, we also know that they can hurt people.
Fire bad.
Yeah.
Fire good, but also bad.
So technology almost always has a bad side. All right.
We can get into a whole philosophy.
Another thing that I did.
All right.
I did this last night.
We're moving on. That's fine.
No, well, this is actually more about me being a bit of a Google apologist, so you can tease me about this, too. Yesterday, I noticed that our Google Plus page for GeekSpeak wasn't certified or some kind of thing that Google does. And what you have to do is you have to basically link from your site using a special link that's called a publisher REL. It doesn't matter the details of it. Mm-hmm. So I added that to the GeekSpeak site. And in doing that, I realized, we should have a badge up on the GeekSpeak site. But then I was just doing a Google badge. So up at geekspeak.org, you can actually see our Google Plus. I think there's 84 people that like our page, whatever, and you can follow us and
so
all that.
Room for more.
But I went ahead and also put up Facebook and Twitter as well. So if you're curious, I mentioned every once in a while you can follow us and all that at the end of the show.
Yeah.
Well, now it's actually really easy to do that. Go to geekspeak.org, and on the right-hand side at the bottom, you can blah, 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 and click on that. Now, the show that we do every week, we put up a podcast, but of course, we also put up all our notes about the show, and we have an update from previous. So as the show unfolds, the content of the site will be explained. But let's go on to other stories, shall we?
Okay. I'm just trying to find this badge you're talking about.
Oh, are you at geekspeak.org?
A badge like what? Yeah, I went to geekspeak.org, and then I went to the Google Plus. So it's at...
Oh, the geekspeak.org on there, that little...
Oh, I
thing.
See. So there it is. Like down at the bottom of all of the goopus on the right-hand side is a thingo that says GeekSpeak, G+, follow.
Right.
And
then there's
badge.
A Twitter and a Facebook one above that.
Yeah.
And you can
82 people have done that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, 82 people have plused it. I don't know. It doesn't matter.
We've got,
let's go
like
on.
112 people in our circles.
There you go. That's
whatever
what it was.
Means.
Whatever that means. Right. Following us on circles.
All right. Now for content.
Yes, please. So we've gone with that. I think you go ahead. You've got a great little story.
Well, this amused me.
I want to tell you about. Go ahead.
Yeah. This is a great story. Well, actually, it's not that great a story. That's the thing.
Oh.
A French company called, Spotter? Is doing analytics on traditional and social media with the intent of spotting sarcasm for your benefit.
Okay.
Presumably so that you can respond to
consumers. But is that for
consumers.
Your benefit?
For your benefit. They've gotten somewhere, right? At the beginning of this project, maybe they like caught 50% instances of sarcasm just through analytics and automatic stuff and computed guesswork.
When we talk about artificial intelligence and dissecting speech, even written speech by artificial intelligence, sarcasm comes up as one of those problem spaces. Because you have to be pretty, and you have to understand a lot to understand sarcasm.
Yeah, you can appear to be saying one thing, but really be saying something else. Like, thank you so much to X Airline for me being 2 hours late for my flight. Thanks.
Right.
Right.
And of course, online, you don't have the tonality of the speech. It's interesting because, of course, children have this problem sometimes, right? They'll misunderstand a sarcasm.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm very sarcastic with children. But that's true.
But experiments could be.
To know that was sarcastic, that two-hour example, for example, of being late, is you have to understand that in the human condition, people don't like to be late, right?
Right.
So you have to understand a context about meaning before dissecting meaning from the sentence.
Yeah. Now, what would have made this article more interesting if they had explained a bit their algorithms and how they spotted sarcasm. And apparently they're now at 80%, not 50%, which is great.
I wanted you to do the story. I didn't read this article, but I wanted you to do the story so bad because I love the idea of talking about sarcasm. It's so much fun.
Well, what was interesting is when I saw it on Boing Boing, which
I love Boing Boing.
As you may know, is my only source of tech news.
Mark Fraunfelder would be very happy to hear that.
I sure would. And what they did is just provided a link with the headline and the words, "Well, this is just lovely." And those words, "Well, this is just lovely," effectively conveyed sarcasm with just the words.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Nice and
those
short
words in that construction is sarcastic.
Yeah. That's great.
So maybe that's a clue toward what, you know, these.
So you got to tell these people, and then they'll get 84%. Because that's if you look inside these words, it's sarcasm. Let me tell you.
But you know, apparently, this is something that they're currently charging a minimum of £1,000 a month. This is from a BBC site. This story. So, £1,000 per month for its services. I don't know how many people are taking them up on that crazy offer for something that's only 80% accurate.
Right.
You know, and what they're doing with
is 80% worth that kind of money? Yeah. You know, people want to invest in artificial intelligence. That's just the way it is.
But it's as tricky as that This American Life story a million years ago about trying to devise a nose that can pick up smells. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of more qualitative than quantitative. Although with smells, there's actual esters that have a shape. And
that's true.
Yeah.
So I hadn't heard that story. I'll have to research it.
Go back in time.
Hey, so a research group in Britain, and actually at the University of Southampton, mm-hmm. Southampton. God, I can't do that. Southampton. Has developed a five-dimensional storage medium. This article is wrapped in wonderful words like high-speed femtosecond laser. But basically what's going on is we are always looking for more compact storage medium. Mm-hmm. It's the thing that it's in the psyche of as you get digital data, you want to be able to store it better and better and better.
Well, and if the NSA is going to pick up that much information,
they're going to need storage.
Need storage.
Absolutely.
That's manageable.
So let's get some storage numbers correct.
Yeah.
Right off the bat, let's talk about what a normal size thing that we can all comprehend. A DVD, a Blu-ray DVD player. So a Blu-ray disc. That's kind of the largest mass media storage density system. It's a write once only medium. It's a disc the size of a Blu-ray or CD, and or a DVD or a CD, and it holds 128 gigabytes. So 128 gigabytes. So you can think of 128 gigabytes as a really big film, lots of data. You know, you get cutscenes and all that. There's actually a lot of data there, and it's high resolution. So mm-hmm. we can just conceptualize that's the size right now of a Blu-ray disc. If you were to make using this five-dimensional crystal self-assembled nanostructures infused quartz technology from Britain, you could get 360 terabytes of data on the same size disk. So 128 gigabytes versus 360 terabytes. And of course, that's 1,000 times bigger.
Okay, so that's bigger.
That's a lot. So now, a 1,000 times... 3,000 times larger than a DVD. That's what kind of crystal structure.
Okay, so let me get my head around five dimensions. Yeah. So there's three dimensions.
This
there's
is great.
Space, right? There's the fourth dimension, that's time. What's the fifth dimension again?
Good question. That's actually kind of a misnomer. Of course, there's only three dimensions in this thing, right? They've got the three dimensions of X, Y, and Z, right? The crystal itself is stuck in that three-dimensional space.
Yeah.
And then they're also talking about two more attributes of the storage medium as being the last
two dimensions,
right? And I think that
is that it's self-organizing?
It is self-organizing. As you heat up the crystal, it forms a certain type of structure, and you hit that with a... Basically, you're hitting these little tiny crystals, and you can set up its location, of course. That's normal three-dimensional. And then its optical... Two types of optical qualities about it. And those two help determine the differentiation of that bit.
So, different layers of seeing with one lens, you see one layer of information, and with another lens, you see another deeper layer?
It would probably be more like the polarization and the reflective index. So, some qualities of light that you can detect. Not polarization, of course, a little harder to detect, but we understand that we can see it. So,
you have polarized sunglasses, it means that the glare is off the surface of the water.
Right.
Useful for fisher folk.
Exactly. So, the idea behind this is that you're basically making really, 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 really small dots inside a crystal structure, and the density is great. And of course, this is crystal, storage medium. Does that make you think of anything?
Superman.
Yes, good. Superman memory crystals is what the other one they're calling it. You know that little crystal rod that Superman has that has
really?
His entire
That's what
planet information? They're talking about it as being very similar. In fact, we've known for a long time that crystal structures give you a lot of structure in a base type, the smallest form you can. Mm-hmm. And structure, of course, is a big part of how you deal with memory. Mm-hmm. The other thing about this stuff that's amazing is that it can handle thousands of degrees centigrade. It lasts kind of forever. It'll last for, it goes up to 1,000 degrees centigrade, and it's still structurally
hard to
stable.
Burn.
Yeah, basically this stuff, if we store it on this, it'll last forever.
And how do you shred it? Like when criminals are storing information, how do they get rid of it fast?
You have to have beams come out of your eyes and destroy it with your eyes. Yeah. I think you just shatter it. I think that would probably do it too.
Can Google Glass do that?
Not yet. That's the extras feature that is going to be horrible soon.
Death ray lasers. Pew.
Hey, you listen to Geek Speak. We're here every week. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Bonnie Jean Prince. We're going to be taking calls in the second half of the show.
And on the next 7th Avenue project here on KUSP, filmmaker David Hoffman has a rage for storytelling. Over the last 50 years, he's made hundreds of documentaries, creating a vast record of life in America from the 1960s to the present. On this edition of the 7th Avenue Project, Hoffman describes his own life behind the camera, how movies alter our sense of ourselves, and why we shouldn't always trust documentary films. That's tomorrow at noon on KUSP 88.9 or at KUSP.org.
Every week we talk about geek bits, and a geek bit is something you have to see to believe. So, Bonnie, you got to come over here and see this.
How am I going to do this?
Actually, you know what? I'll just turn my screen around. You watch that. The music is playing, and I'll just read a little bit about it.
That looks like a contraption being constructed over time.
You can find out about this at geekspeak.org.
So fast.
Quixotic Kickstarter-founded project was won by the Stritskotsky Prize. They won the Stritskotsky Prize. And it's the most elusive goals in aviation by keeping a human-powered helicopter aloft for more than a minute. And that is the attempt and success of human-powered helicopter.
Look at that. Well, apparently, in part, it happens with very wide wings.
Yes.
And the entire hangar is the wingspan, basically, of this helicopter.
Yeah, really kind of inspirational. The music, of course, helps with inspiration.
Does.
But
yeah,
basically, you're seeing a bicyclist who clearly knows how to bike, right?
Yeah.
This guy's got legs.
Yeah.
And he's sitting on a bicycle that's kind of suspended from a whole bunch of wires.
Looks a little bit like that dude from the Triplets of Belleville.
Yes, it totally reminded me of that, exactly. Yeah. So, four helicopter blades. It looks like they're probably a diameter of about 12 to 15 feet, and they're really widespread. So the device is huge, but clearly...
Yeah, what am I seeing? They're in front and back?
There's four of them all around him. Yeah, he's in the center. So just imagine four helicopter blades that are about 12 feet or... in diameter, circling, and in the center of that is Bicyclist, who's powering that. It's pretty cool. So you can see this up at geekspeak.org. They succeeded at winning the prize, which has been elusive for, I don't know, humankind.
Right, yeah, since the beginning
of
wanting
to fly. That person flew by their own muscle strength on Earth.
I want to see it outside.
I know.
Any
wind, there's no
floaty.
Control at all. It's very much, I can go up now.
Yep.
And now we're going down.
I'm higher.
But it's freaking amazing. I want to try it. Give it a shot.
That's
and I love
cool.
The very end of the video has like 400 logos on it. You know, there's a lot of money put into it.
everybody had a piece in that one.
Absolutely.
Well, how useful is that? Not very useful, but it looks fantastic.
It does look fantastic. And that's what the Geek Bits are about. It's actually to kind of get you guys to take a look at our website. And of course,
that's the whole point.
Every time I say that, I wish, I should have published that already. But we're still working on it. The show's still going. So
still
geekspeak.org.
Going. Geekspeak.org. Well, you know, what's fun about that is it looks like one of those Harder's Archive Victorian wood engravings of a contraption.
Oh, yeah. It's way you know, brings technology, knowledge, thoughts into your mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
hey, last week we talked a bit about internet radio. Somebody called in about, like, I need to do this and that and this. And we had a few responses.
Oh, yeah.
Anthony,
they were looking for a thingo so they could listen to internet radio without having their computer stuck to their stereo.
That's right. The connecting your stereo and all that. And there's lots of solutions, and I didn't have any at the time. But Anthony Sacco suggested, from San Jose, California, he bought a Barnes & Noble Nook HD, and he discovered the TuneIn Radio Pro. And he says that TuneIn Radio... I'm basically reading what he wrote us.
Okay.
TuneIn Radio on the Nook HD is a great experience. Not only does it stream, but it also allows simultaneous recording that I can play back later. Ooh. It's easy to find new stations, and it saves them saves them in a favorites collection. It's very easy to use. So he's basically suggesting find a wireless device that's portable and then plug that in. And actually, that's kind of interesting because that's basically just making the computer a lot less, a lot more portable. Mm-hmm. But it's true that most of the radio you hear is streamed live. You can listen to Geek Speak and all of KUSP at kusp.org/live.html, something like that. And you can link to it from the
You can click
homepage.
To it easily from the homepage. Yeah.
He also says, by the way, if you want to hear your internet stream on any FM radio in your house, just plug in a low-powered FM transmitter into the Nook's audio jack. And that's another point. The simplest way to get audio onto your radio is to rebroadcast yourself an FM transmission. Now, I actually... I think you and I are licensed by the FCC to be on the radio, right? So we technically should not be saying this because those things are illegal. Those little tiny low... Well, I wouldn't say they're illegal. The low-powered things that actually transmit in the FM spectrum, I guess they're not because they're being sold, so probably not. It used to be that they were illegal and you had to buy them as a kit and put them together, but now they're sold all the time. So I'm assuming that because of the low-power nature, they don't break the rules of the FCC.
Well, hadn't there been some loosening up about low-power radio?
Yeah, I think that's probably what it is.
Maybe that's why.
Anyway, so that was one of the suggestions. There are a lot of solutions out there. And because I don't use them directly, I can't recommend. But always we take recommendations from listeners and try to put them up on the website after the show and all that. So if you'd like to email us recommendations for anything on today's show, please feel free to do so. Our email address is geeks@geekspeak.org. All right. A little announcement. Do you see this? You want to read this announcement or should I do this?
Where is this? Where are we?
Oh, you know, I'll do it. Oh, maybe, you know.
Where are we?
Well, where are we? We're in the 1022 start section, too.
Okay. Oh, we're still there.
We're reading the internals of how Geekspeak works. Bonnie and I share a Google Doc document. We can, of course, invite people to call in, too.
The announcement of calendar need?
Yeah, do you like
that? I can read that, sure. Yeah. So the city of Santa Cruz is seeking a tech lead for a project for an event. And it's the Economic Development Department spearheading a countywide effort to simplify the process of posting and sharing event information in Santa Cruz County. This project, by the way, lots of organizations, including KUSP at one time, was puzzling about how to make this happen. So it's lovely to see that the city's taking a crack at it. It will utilize existing open source technology to network and aggregate existing data and limit the need for event producers to post duplicate information. How lovely would that be?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Now, this is a common trend, I think, in as we go online. There's a lot of these online calendars, and all of them have slightly different information. And it's actually kind of a trick to figure out where the source is the best place. And if you're involved in an organization that does events, as you did, you do still, I think,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
I do that with Mountain Community Theater. When you have an event and you want to post it, you might spend 3 or 4 hours trying to hit all the resources. And that's kind of silly. It's the same data.
Yeah. And when you're a low to the ground nonprofit, you know, with just a scrap of a budget and a big heart and a big dream, then it's, you know, it's hard to spend the time to post at a bunch of individual calendars.
When Geekspeak was first starting, I came back to the area and started the show up. There was a project like this, mm-hmm. and the idea was to make a calendar application website, mm-hmm. And it was developed for a while. It was done in Perl. I followed it a bit and kind of was involved in the sense that I knew it was happening and I knew who was doing it and all that. Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen, you know, it didn't go anywhere.
Well, it's nice that this one's open source. That really seems to be the way to go.
And I've talked a little bit about the people that are running this, and the plan around it is really not to rebuild a centralized system, but to enable a whole bunch of people to use to sync the sources data. Mm-hmm. So it's a better way of doing it. I'm kind of excited about it. So if you know anything, if you're interested in this project and you're a developer, especially if you know anything about, what's the name of the product? Ah, darn it. Well, if you're interested in this project, please do visit geekspeak.org. We'll have that. Yeah.
Yeah. And basically, the city right now is looking for a consultant or a team of consultants to act as a technical lead through the process of implementing the project, including setup, training key partners, development of tools as needed.
If I didn't have a job, I'd be doing it because it sounds awesome.
And you've got till July 26th to get yourself signed up, and we'll have a link to how to get signed up at geekspeak.org.
Sweet. All right. Going on. You've heard probably, Bonnie, a lot about the PRISM and the NSA tapping our data and all of that.
Yeah.
And in these discussions, there's a lot of smoothing over the actual technical details. Mm-hmm. But I have to say that I can describe the technical details, and a couple of them have been of interest. I thought you might want to know.
Okay, yeah. What are they doing, actually?
So one thing to note is that in the past few years, almost all of these online services, Facebook and Google and Twitter, have switched over to HTTPS. That's mm-hmm. the secure web traffic. Mm-hmm. And I've talked about this a lot before. SSL or TLS, these are the acronyms, not that important, but if you actually see the little green lock icon up in the top bar, and this has been going on for years, mm-hmm. and it says HTTPS on the website, mm-hmm. what this means is that your browser and a website have been communicating encryptedly. And
let me ask you this, because on some sites like our Geekspeak show page,
we don't do that. Yeah.
I've got an HTTPS with a green lock. And then if I look on my Facebook page, I've got HTTPS with a lock and a little warning triangle.
Interesting.
So what's the difference between those two?
Well, the details have to do with how the handshaking is happening between the browser and the website. Mm-hmm. And the reason why you'll see the little warning, most likely what's happening is on that page there's also non-secure information.
That seems entirely likely.
Yeah. Now,
at Facebook.
The companies around this are very, they want that green lock. They want it to be secure. But more than that, there's been some examples of when they don't use that secure process and you're in a coffee shop and you're using Wi-Fi, somebody can run an application and sniff all the data. We've covered this over the years. Mm-hmm. The idea is that if you're not doing that, anybody that can intersect the communication between the two locations can see everything you're doing.
Right.
So this is a man-in-the-middle attack is the general concept of that. Okay. And that works really well if you're at a Wi-Fi and you're not using SSL. Mm-hmm. So we've suggested for years to move to SSL, to move to HTTPS all the time, and you'll see that what major websites are kind of enforcing it. You can't really use the websites without doing that. Right. It's actually very difficult. And the reason is very simple. If you're at a coffee shop and you connect to a website and pass your data along, everything you do is very easy to detect because in the Wi-Fi point, all you have to do is listen. You just have to have an antenna and listen. Mm-hmm. And the apps are pretty easy and they just pull all the data in. Now, if you do SSL, the HTTPS, the TLS, that secure data connection, mm-hmm. what's happening is the very first thing that occurs is you contact a website and you say, hey, I know who you are. Please tell me who you are. I'm asking for the site. And they'll send you back a certificate, an SSL certificate. That certificate will have been signed, meaning digitally fingerprinted, if you will, kind of a little stamp of approval from another source, a certificate authority. This is a third party. Mm-hmm. Your browser, when you download your browser, it has a list of trusted third-party people. So your browser actually knows, hey, these are the 80 or 100 or whatever companies that are trusted.
And this all happens automatically. You're not physically communicating this.
All happens automatically.
It happens automatically.
So when you download Chrome or Firefox or Safari or Internet Explorer or Opera, the list of trust certificates, the people that you can trust, are already known, and you have their public certificates. These are the things that allow you to check if the fingerprint's real. Mm-hmm. So let's do a scenario, a metaphoric scenario. Yeah. I'm here, and I want to talk to you, Bonnie, mm-hmm. about a website. Mm-hmm. So I say, please give me my email. And you say, first off, here's a certificate. And I grab the certificate first, and I say, let me see. And I look for the certificate, and I see that there's a stamp of approval. And then I look in my trusted list, and I say, does this stamp match? And then I check it, and I algorithmically check it. Mm-hmm. And I run it. I go, whoa, I can trust you because someone I trust has trusted you.
Okay.
So it's a trust scenario.
Yeah.
And it's interesting we talk about computers and trust. This is how you think about it because that's the language we have. So now, because I have a trust with you and I know that we've got some information and I have your public record you just handed me that I checked, mm-hmm. you can now initiate a communication with me or I can initiate a communication with you. I can send a request to you saying, hey, let's talk to each other and we'll use this strategy. Mm-hmm. And when I send that information to you, I use your public certificate, the thing that we know is you. Mm-hmm. I encrypt it again with that, the first handshake, which shares what we're going to use. You get a copy from it. You're the only one that can unencrypt it because you have the secret that matches the thing you gave me. Mm-hmm. I know this is kind of complicated. Sorry about
this. But this is how most...
This is how the secure protocols work, yeah.
It's how one navigates through the web generally.
Right.
Is all that sort of like going on.
And this all happens
from loading a page.
Right. And this all happens because mathematically we can do public key, private key, mm-hmm. meaning that there's a public thing I can share with everyone and I can receive data that's encrypted with that public key. I'm the only one that can unencrypt it because I have the private key. So you're the private key holding the situation. I've encrypted the first message. The first message is actually, hey, let's use this completely random thing to encrypt everything we talk about at this point on. Mm-hmm. And I give you a copy of it. And now you and I communicate only using that one-time use. Got and we're going to use that for the session of communication. Mm-hmm. We're going to encrypt everything with this one thing.
So the next time I visit the web, your website, Lyle,
yes,
there'll be a different...
We'll
look to that certificate.
The original public certificate will be the same for 2 years or so.
Okay.
But the communication that we get to use every time we have a session, we make a new random one.
Okay.
And the reason is the public key, private key is a little more complicated and it takes more processing time. Mm-hmm. But I have a large number and everything I do, I'm going to encrypt with that large number. And you have the same number, you can unencrypt it. It's very fast. So we hand each other that information in the trusted environment. Okay.
So this quick exchange is happening generally.
Yeah, this happens really fast anytime HTTPS happens. Okay. Faster than humans can think. It doesn't really matter. But the point of it is that now if there's another person on the side, they never get the chance to do what we just did. They can't see our secrets. Mm-hmm. They can see the traffic go by, but it's encrypted. Now, there's a lot of talk about, well, is it encrypted enough that a supercomputer can't unencrypt it and can it be hacked? And the truth is as our technology gets better at doing speedy tasks, we make these things bigger and bigger and bigger. It used to be that the keys were relatively small, mm-hmm. and now they're lots bigger. And every time you double their size, you by a factor of magnitude, you square their complexity. Mm-hmm. Okay.
There are lots of little nooks and crannies in the key.
Right.
So it unlocks a particular lock.
So this base knowledge and then the knowledge that the NSA with the PRISM system has been grabbing all our data from all these online sites, mm-hmm. The technologist in me, for example, when I first heard this, said, oh my gosh, the only way the NSA could actually get this data is if they could ask Google or Facebook or whatever to have a feed. So this was the assumption that there's in cahoots. But then the big companies all said, no, we're not in cahoots with the government. That's not what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So then there's a question of who's lying
What's really happening?
Is the report correct or not?
Well, and so then I have a question about what gets encrypted. Like, can the NSA see that there's a conversation about encryption happening between me and Lyle?
Yes. So By default, that's easy to do.
So that's the same as you made a call to this person, and then you made a call to that person, and I can infer what the conversation was about because of what I know about this person and that person.
Right, and we can also produce pretty interesting social networks with that. But the thing is, the data that's inside the Facebook and the Google and stuff is much more impressive on social network building than just the communications. Because if I'm talking to you through Facebook, really, you're talking to Facebook and I'm talking to Facebook. And anybody snooping that has no idea that you and I are talking because it all goes through Facebook. And same with actually Google email. If you send a message from email to email in Google, it never goes to the outside network. Oh, Google's the only one that knows about the communication.
Oh.
Except that when I actually view the web page, if you could look at that web page, you could see a whole bunch of data about it. But you can't because of the SSL certificate.
So the question became... Yeah, what is the NSA seeing?
Yeah, so what is the NSA doing? First off, yes, communication's interesting. That's interesting to know that you're talking to Facebook a lot or you're going to a website and downloading lots of traffic because the amount of packets, the amount of data is also known. How frequently, when you do it, a lot of patterns, a lot of meta information can be discovered. But there's another thing that came about in thinking about this pretty thoroughly, and that is that the reason why... So the NSA basically has also talked about building... The government's building large data centers, right, to store all this data. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing that's interesting about data. That communication that you and I have through SSL that is completely opaque to anybody else, if I had the keys, I could look at it, right? Mm. It's unencryptable. You and I encrypt it and then unencrypt it because we have a key.
So this is where the question about how much corporations are cooperating with NSA comes into play because how much access to those keys do they have?
That's right. So the question is, could the U.S. government have a subpoena and say, hey, you know what? I need your SSL certificates because now I can look at the data of this one person. The only way to look at that data, the data is lost forever. It's not, you know, it's a communication system. Mm-hmm. They want to prove something. A court says, yes, give it to them. Then Google could potentially have to give their certificate to the government. That certificate could be used to unencrypt all the traffic. So that's a little creepy. That seems like something the company might not do. But then again, if it's a court order and it seems legal, why wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. But the other thing that's very interesting about that, I mentioned that the certificate that we handle actually expires after 2 years. Mm-hmm. They always expire. In fact, Google makes a lot of them and they expire quickly. So the question is, if it's expired and no more new traffic is happening, then why wouldn't you give it to the government? Right? It's old. Who cares?
Okay.
So now you could have a scenario where you tap the backbone of the internet, you record everything you possibly can. Then 2 years later, you go to the companies, you say, give me your old certificate. We're researching a project. Mm-hmm. And they say no, but then the judge says, no, you have to. And the certificate's given over. They go through all the storage and they unencrypt all of it.
So they unencrypt a lot of two-year-old information, and there could be lots of embarrassing stuff in that two-year-old information.
Basically, that's how you could do this without much help by the companies that actually own the data or access the data. So the thing that's creepy about that is that totally makes sense. The way to do this is store all the data until the keys are known and then unencrypt it. And it just shouldn't, it wouldn't be that hard to do this.
But, so then it would be creepy for citizens, but if you were, working on some crime. What you did 2 years ago might not be as relevant as what hatch you are scheming right now.
Yeah.
So would the NSA be really spending their effort on two-year-old information if they're trying to catch things that are happening in the moment?
Well, there's a, you know, if you listen to the people that I tend to believe on this kind of topic, it's not that the people that are doing the snooping are going to be successful at actually getting information and helping and fighting terrorism, which of course this is about. It's more that they do it because they've got to do something, I don't have a lot of faith that the NSA tapping all this information will have any relevance or usefulness.
So it's like the TSA taking our liquids.
Exactly.
They got to do something.
They got to do something. It's theater.
It's the body scans.
Now,
they got to do something.
The thing that's not good about it is as you build these systems, you collect all this data, you're going to find really nasty information about
people. The NSA. Why is the NSA concerned with theater?
Well, they're not, but they have to do something. And they do know that if communication's happening in a certain medium and they're not looking at that medium, they're being blind to it. So do everything you possibly can to unencrypt it. The problem is the amount of data we're talking about is massive.
Yeah, they need those Superman crystals.
They do. In fact, the storage selects problem is a serious problem. We produce so much data, it's unbelievable. The amount of photos you
do. So we should just be looking at websites more than we need to just to flood them with more information than they require.
Oh, there's browser plugins to do this. They'll just randomly download lots of stuff, yeah.
People have thought about this stuff.
Unfortunately. Yeah, I mean, the truth is, I'd love to see that it's actually useful. The other thing that's really interesting is that the government, of course, is saying, hey, don't worry about it. We're just looking to try to help, right? Trust us. Mm. And yet, it doesn't work the other way around. We say, hey, well, then tell us what you're doing, and nada.
Yeah,
so I'm not into it.
The certificate.
But anyway, there's the technical explanation to some degree of how they might be able to get that SSL data.
Possibly, right?
Possibly.
Yeah.
We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. I'll give the phone number out again in just a second. But first, let me let you know that Rick's in the other room. Rick helps out every week answering phones
every
and piping
week.
Them through. He's awesome. Thank you, Rick. And in the air with me is Bonnie Jean Primsch, and I'm Lyle E. Troxel.
E? What's the E stand for?
Excellent. speaking of awesome middle initials, in high school, I had I've had a few people that have taught me stuff in my life that have gotten me very inspired. I won't list everybody, but I will list one.
Okay.
Here's one. My high school, Preston Q.
Ooh.
Boomer. Now, Boom, as he's well known and loved, has been teaching high school in the San Lorenzo Valley High School physics, chemistry for 75 years teaching. And in his history, he's had...
Did he start when he was five?
Exactly. He got out of college and started teaching. And Boom, one of those science teachers who's like, let's talk about physics. Let's talk about it. And he'll light something on the bench and it blows up. And everyone's like, what?
Are you saying that he's a delightful curmudgeon?
He is wonderful. I wouldn't even say curmudgeon. He's a fantastic guy. Boom... I was a student in high school in science, nothing else.
Yeah, sure.
But Boom was very inspiring. And one of the things he's done in his career, his high school career, he's actually built a castle and catacombs and a pipe organ at his house in Bonnie Doon.
Yes,
you've probably heard about it.
Have
you ever been?
No, I never have.
I will take you next week.
Oh, okay. Are you serious?
Yes. There'll be a concert and it's kind of a... I won't tell everybody about it, but you and I can go.
Yay.
So Boom's fantastic. And Boom, unfortunately, before my children got to high school, has retired after 75 years. And
what a selfish man.
In that time, he has had students which have gone through the program, gone through high school, went to college, got a teaching degree, came back, became a teacher, taught at the place, then became the principal, became his boss, and then retired. That's happened to him more than once.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. He's taught his boss, and that boss retired. That's how long Boom's been teaching. Anyway.
So what's the Q stand for?
He has different answers for that.
Oh,
that's the thing
I
that's
see.
Wonderful. And that's why I mentioned that I said excellent.
Okay.
It's like Q. I don't even know if his middle initial is Q. He's that mysterious. But Preston Q Boomer, Boom. I would not be having the life that I have of being a technical expert without people like you in my life. So thank you so much
for
being awesome. Okay, moving on to calls before I get too teary.
Hey, wait a minute. Rick had a question, though.
Oh, yeah. What's the question?
Well, he wanted to know what the incentive for keeping around old keys were, right? Like if the certificates expire after a couple of years, why would a company keep that around?
That's a good question. Actually, a company could delete them pretty quickly after using them. It's hard to delete data, but these things are actually really privately held in the company. So the way that Google uses it it's kind of tricky because you have to use it on all your web servers. You have to have this private key for it to function. It has to be loaded in such a way, but Google has thousands and thousands of web servers. It's a complicated system.
Yeah.
So they probably have a whole management software about it. And it's possible they could just add in a delete immediately. It's also possible the government could say, I want that key before it's gone. So that's a good question. Yeah, they're the only ones that have it. So if they deleted it right away, then it wouldn't be stuck around. Good question, right?
Also, just a little truth in journalism. Apparently, Rick says that according to the Sentinel, Boom retired after 56 years.
Oh, did I say 57?
Which is still, you said 75, dear.
Oh, he is 80.
Which is blowing
that's
my
what it was.
Mind.
Okay. Oh, you know, it was emotional. Good. I actually have the banner in front of me. I'm glad that he's covering the Sentinel as well.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. 56 years on the job.
There we go.
There you go.
That's,
sorry,
I mean,
I said 75.
There's a confusion that happens. Was it? A friend of mine had his grandparents were together forever.
Yeah.
And they were 90 years old. And when asked how long they'd been married, they'd say, well, about 90, right? 90.
Right, right, right.
You know, they just... It had become so much.
It came their lifetime.
Their marriage was so much of who they were. Yeah.
Definitely Boom's lifetime has been that. So 56 years on the job.
56
years. I mean, that's a long time.
Still impressive.
Yeah, very impressive.
75 would have been more impressive.
Get back to work, Boom.
All right, we got Scott from Las Vegas. He wants to know something.
That's right. Scott, welcome to Geeksby.
How you doing?
Quite well. What's your question?
Well, I'm, for the most part, a PC user. But I have an iPod Touch, and my PC is starting to act funny, and I fear that the hard drive might be failing. It could also be a RAM issue, but I haven't gotten that far. So I've been backing up data, and I realized the one thing I haven't backed up is my iTunes information, so that if I do redo the hard drive, I want to go to Windows 7, that kind of thing, how can I get my iPod information back so that iTunes looks like it does currently?
And so basically, you want to wipe your iPad completely and then reinstall and have all the information back.
Yeah,
huh?
Pretty much. And I know there's iCloud, so I really am curious about iCloud and how much you might know about it.
Yeah, well, it is possible to do that through iCloud. If you've got a computer, any computer that has iTunes on it, you can actually do a full backup of the system. Even without syncing all the data, you can do backups to iTunes machines from your iPad. And that backup is a complete restore type backup, and I would recommend that one first. The iCloud is more selective in what you do with it.
Right, and like I said, I've had to restore my iPod many times.
Yeah.
Or I got a new iPod and I wanted it to look like the old iPod. And that worked fine, but my concern is the iTunes on the computer itself, the fact that I've got all these playlists and it knows where all the songs are.
It's that you're concerned about. Yeah, you'll have to back that up separately. Then that's not the iOS devices. The iOS device will not handle your backup of iTunes. So if you want to keep all the data, like what your playlists are and what you've subscribed to with your podcasts and what you listen to all the time and all your songs, you have to back up that library. iTunes does have a pretty good library management system. I think it has a backup feature, but it really...
It's just for stuff you get through iTunes.
That's what I haven't found.
Okay, so and you're on a Windows environment.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the tricky part.
That is.
Yeah, well, only in the sense that it's definitely not their focal point. Right. I would say
and
that Apple doesn't make the best.
When I've talked to Apple about other issues, like I bought my daughter an iMac and we were expecting to be able to burn DVDs. And when we went to do it, iDVD or whatever it was called, wasn't on the computer. When I called Apple, it says, oh, we're moving away from solid media and going to the cloud.
Yes.
And it says, well, the school who wants to watch this DVD tomorrow morning at 7 a.m., does not do the cloud. We need to take a physical DVD in. So we had to actually purchase software that we were told was on the computer, but we had to purchase it. So I don't know if this is something they want me to be able to do. I do find a folder under users and my name and everything called iTunes.
Yeah, that's where it is.
If I copy that onto an external hard drive and I redo my main hard drive, new operating system, whatever I have to do, can I just copy that back in? And
yeah, you can.
It's not iTunes to it.
It's not just that library folder. That library folder is library definition, but there's also settings files as well. In a Macintosh environment, I could tell you it's inside this thing called library and then inside application support. On a Windows machine, I'm not sure where those extra preference files are. They're probably under documents and settings under a preference area, and you've got to find those as well. But the thing I would highly recommend is to back up your entire computer before doing this as well, because then when you restore, you will get all this data back.
Right.
Right. But no, it's kind of a management process. And most likely someone's built an application to do this as well. But it is as simple as copy everything that's inside your library, your iTunes folder, and then go find the preference file and do that as well. Now, when you redo this, but before you do this, I would unregister the iTunes as a playable source. Apple actually has, because of DRM stuff, they actually have the amount of things that can play your music, and that count, I think they can set up to 5, and as you use them, they go away. So before you actually deinstall this installation, go ahead and go and unapprove this for your content. And then it won't have to expire over a period of time. You'll force the expiration of that. And then back up everything first, then expire this, then destroy your system, rebuild, reload all this stuff in. And then one of the things you have to do is reapprove the iTunes to be able to play the media. If you have media that's DRM, Apple's moved away from DRM in some sense. So some of these things are not.
I would say 80% of the media I have are MP3s that I ripped long before I went into iTunes.
I do it that way too.
But the reason why I brought up the cloud thing is I haven't gone to the cloud. I have some content that, that's not necessarily for general consumption. Let's say I was a band and I didn't want to share my music.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I used to mix live shows, and I have board tapes from years ago, and some of them are in my library. I don't want the cloud to bring those up.
I'm not a big believer in putting all your content in some other hands. Mm-hmm. I think that you should definitely manage that content yourself and be aware of it.
Different folder, don't put that one up.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way to do it. I also, putting everything on the cloud, the reason why they want you to do that is for their own.
It's convenient for them.
Yeah, it's good for them. I mean, they're definitely giving you a service, but you can do it yourself.
They have this file exchange program where if they recognize a song, and if you ripped it yourself, they would replace it.
Yeah.
Well,
I know. I don't think so. Good luck, Scott. Thanks so much for the call.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, we join you in skepticism there.
Yeah, just this whole move to the cloud. I mean, the thing that's nice is that as you duplicate your data into other places, when your hard drive fails, and hard drives fail, mm-hmm. you don't lose it. That's a major win, I would say, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's
the number? 800-655-5877.
That's
time for another call.
That's right. We have another call, John from Big Sur. But, there he is, flashing away. Hi, John. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I have a Western Digital external hard drive hooked up to my MacBook Pro. Mm-hmm. And recently, it's not showing up on my desktop, and I did get some kind of warning saying that Time Machine was no longer backing up, and I needed to repartition my disk or something like that.
Mm. So the disk has actually run out of space, probably.
I suppose. Yes, it must have.
And so what's your question?
Well, I'm just wondering, what do you do now? I mean, it's not showing up on my desktop, and...
It sounds like if it's repartitioned and it's not showing up on your desktop, then you've got a problem with that drive. That's a problem. That means your machine is no longer seeing it. You in a Macintosh environment, you can go ahead and open an application called Disk Utilities. It's under Applications Utilities, Disk Utility, and run that, and then it'll show all the things that are connected, even if it's not really working, and you can try to repair it. That might function. The other thing to do is, unplug it, make sure that you've got the power cord attached to it still, if it has a power cord. Plug it back in and see if you got it. Also do a boot recycle. So these are the basic first steps. If you still don't see it, if it doesn't show up when, even in Disk Utility, that means you've got a really serious problem with the actual enclosure. The hard drive might not be a problem at all. It also might be a problem at the hard drive level. So hopefully this is only a backup and therefore totally redundant to your life. You just grab another disk, and that might be time to buy another one. Kind of frustrating. The thing to note is if you did have the only copy on it of some stuff, that's an archive, not a backup, then you needed to go into recovery space, and that's a little more expensive. But definitely try Disk Utility first. The other thing I could highly recommend, is this application called SpinRite. I use it myself, but you have to have a Windows environment to use it right now. And that will actually recover a lot of data if the enclosure is working. The enclosure is the thing that the hard drive is actually in that you connect to your computer. If that fails, it's a different type of problem than the hard drive failing. I hope that answered your question to some degree, John.
Well, yes. I mean, it's partitioned and it has photos and music on one side or however that works.
Yeah.
And then... Yeah, and then Time Machine's working on another part of the disk.
And are any of those things showing up, or are the photos and stuff showing up, and the Time Machine's not?
No, neither one of them is being recognized on the desktop. I did open up this utility, and I began a repair.
Yeah. So you did find it. Yeah. Well, wait for that to finish, and hopefully that will do the trick. If not, you're in a situation where it's data recovery problems, and keep in mind that when you're looking for software for data recovery, there's a lot of scams out there. So it's very hard to determine which ones. You want to use a big name company if you do that kind of stuff. These applications should be about $30. They will do some general checks. The other thing is, if you said it was a you said this is Western Digital. All the manufacturers of products actually have tools that you can download from their sites to inspect and check, and I'd highly recommend that. They might actually have a what's called a firmware update for your drive.
Oh, you could, so you could go to Western Digital's website and
look up that model.
Get a fix from there.
That's definitely a next step for me. That's what I'd be doing. Thank you, John, for the call. I love it when people call from Big Sur.
Yeah, right on.
It's a beautiful place.
Big Sur.
Absolutely. Hey, we didn't get to all the stories today on Geek Speak. Was one of the things you want to mention before we close the show?
Nope, I sure enjoy being here.
Every week.
Hey, often.
Yeah, please find us up at geekspeak.org. And if you've got stories of boom, do share them. In this area, I'd love to hear them. You can, of course, email us with questions and comments to geeks@geekspeak.org or just visit geekspeak.org for all the information about today's show. By the way, all the stuff, you find the show link, the title of the show on the homepage. You click on that and the entire page will have all this other content. I want to mention one little app called Timber. It's the OS app of the week for me. You know about Timber?
I know that they meant to have it pronounced Timber, but
Timber.
No one knew how to do
yeah,
that.
It's Timber. Anyway, it's a great music sharing, finding app. But I guess for me, when I want to find music in this area, I just turn on KWSP. What about you, Bonnie?
Yeah, music.
Absolutely.
It's one-stop shop.
This is Geek Speak. We're here every week. You can learn more about Geek Speak at geekspeak.org. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me was Bonnie Jean Primsch. Bonnie, thanks for being here.
Always good.
For those that listen, thank you. For those that call, thank you. And hope to see you online throughout the week. Stay tuned now for Car Talk.